History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories there that should not go untold. And really, they don't have to go untold if we'll just take a little time to ask a few questions and, more importantly, be patient enough to listen. We'll be amazed by some of the things that come back our way from some of our more experienced neighbors. And when you're 99 years old, you're pretty experienced. We're going to learn that today. But we're here to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, yeah, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often we are inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. I'm in one of my favorite places today in downtown Fresno, California, the Veterans Memorial Museum, home of the Legion of Valor, which had been closed for about a year because of the pandemic, but is back open now every day except Sunday from 10 to 3. And if you come here on a Tuesday, you are sure to find 99-year-old Bill Biggers, one of the volunteer docents here at the museum. Let's start there, Bill, before I ask you about your childhood and take you way back. How long have you been volunteering here now at the Veterans Memorial Museum?
About 10 years.
What was it that made you want to do that?
Well, I was busy with so many other volunteer places, like the Fresno Police Officers Association. I remember that for many years. And I just had too much going to get down here. But once Mike Harris got over here, I decided I better be here.
You got roped in. I love it. And you mentioned the Police Officers Association. Do you know, are you the oldest living Fresno Police Department alum?
Yes, I am.
And you're going to hit the century mark in a few months.
November.
It's coming. All right. Well, I'm sure we'll talk more about this museum and why it's so special to you, but let's go way back. You were born in Oklahoma, right?
Yes.
With a whole lot of sisters.
Well, just one sister when I was. I just had one. The others come later.
And you probably don't even remember anything about Oklahoma. You were so young when you left there.
Yeah, I left there on my birthday. I was 2 years old. But I have a lot of relatives at the time back there, so I got back about every 2 years and visited. My grandparents lived there.
And what was it that brought your family out to California from Oklahoma?
Well, my dad came out here. His father passed away when my dad was 14. He played with an Oklahoma Indian team, the only white man on it, and they traveled around Oklahoma playing different states for 2 years. And then he came here to Fresno, to Kearney Park, went to work for Kearney Park. And he worked there for about 2 years, and then the war came on. Now, while he was here, he played ball with an Italian team. And then he went to the service in World War I. And afterwards, he went back to his hometown in Oklahoma and married my mother. And they came back out here to the same station, and he lived in a little house right by the front gate called the Gatehouse. And that was part of his duty to lock up the park and reopen it in the morning. And he again went to play with the Italian club, but he found out Fig Garden wanted him more. So he went to play ball with the Fig Garden, and they furnished him a house out near there some. I don't exactly know where, but anyway, they stayed there for a couple of years, and then they went back.
He must have been quite a ball player.
He was a good player. He probably would have majors if it, happened a bit back, but then that was not available.
What position did he play?
He was either second base, shortstop, and was a pretty good pitcher.
And you said a few things there that people who live like you do in the Fresno area will recognize, but the people who are listening in other parts, they say, Kearney Park, what's that all about? So there was a man named Kearney who was a real pioneer here, who grew all kinds of things in this area, and his mansion is now a museum out in West Fresno.
Yes, my dad, when he came out here, they were leveling land using Fresno scrapers and mules, and they would level the land and build up dikes where they could flood the land and wash the alkali down. And he done that both times he's out here, because there was nothing planted out there. The big home out there, that was his home, and he hadn't built his deal yet. The ground for it, might be still out there where it was raised, a raised area. That was where he was going to build the big place that never got built. So now they call that the museum.
And you heard all these stories from your father as you were growing up.
Yes.
And you mentioned there that in addition to being a ball player, your father served in World War I.
Yes.
What do you know about what he did in World War One?
Not much. He didn't talk about it.
He was in the Army?
Yes, the Army. I know he worked as an aide to the nurses when they had the big flu epidemic and so many people died.
Yeah, over 100 years ago.
Yeah.
Well, it's been almost 100 years since you were born. So your father has been out here to California, experienced a taste of life, but he's back in his native Oklahoma. That's where you're born. And when you're 2 years old, the family comes out here. What do you remember about your childhood in California? What was it like back then?
Not much, because we didn't stay out here too long, and we went back to Oklahoma. My dad took over farming the property owned by my mother's father. Then they came back out here, and we never went back.
So then you're here in California, and you have another sister and another sister and another sister. You end up the only boy with six sisters. I have to imagine somewhere along the line you were hoping that a little brother would come along.
I didn't have time because I had to stay busy. I had to do all the yard work. Plus, it was invariable that I had to learn to cook, too.
And these are the years of the Great Depression.
Yes.
How did you see that manifested where you were living?
Well, my dad had come out here. He first worked down south for a short period, and then he went out, ended up out here at Biola, worked out there for a professor by the name of Appling, and then he worked for Dr. Hollingsworth. And then he got this job as the superintendent of a large ranch down at Orange Cove. And that's where I started school. First grade was Orange Cove. But I can remember the Depression very vividly, because they were constantly people coming looking for work. I can remember people from the Midwest coming out here. And one piece of property, we had 100 acres of figs. And the only deal was the two little shacks on that, about 10 by 10, and a big windmill that pumped into a tank similar to what you'd have on a cattle farm. And the guys had fresh water and places to take a bath, and they slept out underneath the fig trees. But I can remember men and their wives coming with children in the back and an old car that's barely running, and off to work for nothing, just for flour and stuff to make food for the kids. My mother had always raised a bunch of chickens. She usually had 300 or 400. I had to milk two cows, and I had saddle horses. So my job was also doing that and feeding and gathering those eggs. But she would give them, we always had extra butter, and she'd give them eggs and stuff to eat. And a lot of them, we had a big packing shed in the back where they slept with two fumigating houses that they couldn't close the door on, but they could they could leave them slightly open and be out of the weather. And they also had electricity down there, so they had lights. So a lot of people from Oklahoma, well, I say Oklahoma because they called them Okies.
Sure.
Didn't make any difference which state they came from. They were called Okies. But anyway, we had a lot of them that come there and stayed and would sleep in those houses, especially if they stayed, some of them would stay year-round, until they got enough money to bring the family out. But it was a sad deal to see so many people out of work. I can remember when Roosevelt came in, he started getting rid of the potatoes. They would dye those potatoes purple, and one section of land was all wheat, and they would dump those potatoes on them, but they couldn't get the purple dye on all the potatoes, and people would go over there and get the ones that didn't have dye on them. It was amazing to see that, but it didn't hurt the farmland because we plowed it under anyway.
So you had to work pretty hard as a young man.
Yes, I did. I stayed busy, and Dad insisted that we stay busy because we had a lot of figs, and we had a lot of chores to pick up figs. We got 10 cents for a 40-pound box. That would buy our school clothes. So, yes, we stayed quite busy. Me and my sisters, as they got a little older, they too had to work for the school clothes. Although it was good for us, we had no problems because our home was furnished. Everything was furnished for us, electricity and all that stuff, by some rich, very rich people in San Francisco. The property was owned by them. And Dad run the property just like it was his.
Just an aside, I love figs, and we know that this area, Fresno and Madera County, grow 100% of the figs that are domestically produced in the United States. And I'm just curious, for you, having to work with figs for so long and pick up the good ones and the bad ones that are real messy, did that make you sick of figs, or do you still like them?
No, I love figs, especially Black Missions.
So how'd you get along with all your sisters?
We always got along good. We never had any problems growing up, yeah.
And do you remember at those early ages as a boy having some idea in your mind, hey, when I grow up, here's what I want to do with my life?
Well, yes. Of course, in high school, I had mechanics. I always wanted to be a machinist. And that was my career once. So I went to work for Southern Pacific Railroad in Los Angeles because they had a class that they taught machinery. So I would put in my 8 hours in the field, and then I would put 4 hours in the machine shop.
And I want to ask you about that. I thought of something else too. I mean, you mentioned what a great ball player your father was. Is that something that got passed down to you? Did you play baseball?
No, I didn't. That was very upsetting to Dad, but the school that I went to, they didn't push baseball too much. It was all football and basketball.
Well, if I'm not mistaken, I believe when you were in high school, wasn't Pete Biden the coach at Arosi High?
We had Pete Biden my first 2 years. My freshman and sophomore year, we had Pete Biden. Great coach. Pete and I became friends because he lived down by near Sanger on North Avenue, and I had an uncle that had a dairy there, so Pete became there in his Muscat Vineyard.
Well, and if people go to Fresno State now, they'll see a big bronze statue of Pete Biden where the stadium's named for him because he won 600 games there and took him to the College World Series. That must have been fun for you to see all that happen.
Oh, it was, yeah. I can remember I hadn't seen Pete because he stayed busy after I moved to Fresno. We had a big dinner for the mayor. He was retiring. A sergeant and I got out and sold tickets and had a big dinner for the mayor, and I saw Pete Biden at the door. I said, "Coach." He looked at me. He said, "Well, I recognize the voice, but I don't recognize you," which was just a come on. I knew better than that. It didn't take him long to figure out who I was. He said, "Arosa High School hired me for $120 a month as a coach and a math teacher. And those darn kids from Orange Cove Grammar School knew more math than I did."
And you were one of those kids, huh?
I was one of those kids. And he said, "My wife and I, we couldn't find a job anyplace. And we got down there and we didn't have enough money to rent a house and furnish it. So we stayed with the Dena girls those 2 years." And when I saw him at the dinner that night, I invited him back down to come to celebration of the Rosa High School. From the time it was started in 1921, I believe, or somewhere around that, to the present. And Pete said, "Well, I didn't get an invitation. I'll get you one." So we went down there, and Pete and I had a great time giving everybody a bad time.
And you hit on something there, too, that I guess I need to ask you about. Because, you know, if you go to the Midwest, you might find some people who say Missouri, and you might find some who say Missouri. And out in that eastern part of the San Joaquin Valley here, if you're from Dinuba, you might say Arosi. But if you're from there, you say Arosa. Is that how it works?
Well, yes, a lot of people did. I called it Arosi. But I started in Orange Cove Grammar School, graduated from that, and then I went to Arosa High School.
And I'm sure, well, I'm just guessing, you probably had a fair amount of Japanese-American classmates.
A lot of them. I had run around with twin boys, Yo and Sho. Yes, we had that, and their sister was in my class. So, yes, I had a lot of nice Japanese friends.
I had Sho on this program probably over a decade ago.
Is that right?
Sho Katayama, yeah.
Right.
And if I'm not mistaken, he and his twin both served in the 442nd Regimental Combat Team.
Correct.
Well, and we're getting ahead of ourselves. So the reason I ask you that question, obviously, is even though you graduate in 1939, a couple years later, December 7th, 1941, do you remember where you were and how you found out about that?
I was back on the ranch as a mechanic, tractor driver, truck driver, whatever you want to call it, because I had married in 1940.
Well, I guess I better hit that first if we want to stay chronologically. So you graduate high school in 1939, you get married in 1940. That's pretty quick.
That's pretty quick, yeah. I was working for the Southern Pacific in Los Angeles. I got married.
How'd you meet your wife?
We went to school together. I was a senior and she was a freshman.
Robbing the cradle.
No, we was only 1 year apart. I started early, and then I skipped a grade in high school. I never was a junior. I went from a sophomore to a senior.
You're just that smart, huh?
And made it in 3 years.
Not bad.
I had to catch my sister because she got 1 grade ahead of me.
Now I'm really lost.
Yeah.
You started late and early at the same time almost, it sounds like.
Yeah, we did. We started school together, and so I was a little bit young. And we started the first grade in Orange Cove. Christmas come around, and they moved her to the second, so she's 1 grade ahead of me. It only took me 12 years to catch her.
And I'm sure you let her know about it, too.
Oh, yes.
Well, and I know that you ended up enjoying 70 years of marriage, so I should probably hear about why your wife was so special, why it was so important to you that you got married at such a young age.
Well, of course, we went to school together at least for 1 year. As I say, I was working down to Los Angeles, and it made commute very, very difficult, you know, especially when you just had a little Model A coupe. So anyway, we decided to get married. We had dated for a couple of years, and we decided to get married. Moved to Los Angeles with me, and we stayed down there for a while till I finished up with the machinist, and then I came back to the ranch, where again, we were furnished everything, home and everything else to go with it. In fact, we had a nice home.
This is out in Orange Cove?
Out in the country on the ranch.
So that's where you were on December 7th, 1941.
That's correct, because so many of the men were going into the service, and we were running short, so we brought in Beceros. That was a very good program, very good program. Dad would tell me I need 15 men today, and I could throw boxes in the old truck and put sideboards on and throw some boxes in there for them to set on and go down to the camp and get the 15 men and let them know we was going to use them maybe for a week, 2 weeks, where we thought we needed them. And if it was a good crew, we want the same crew every time, you know. They would give us their box lunches, and at lunch they'd have an hour off to rest and have their lunch, and then at 5 o'clock we took them back to the camp. That was an excellent program. Excellent.
Well, and I think you're kind of hinting at a reality that if they weren't here, if they weren't brought over from Mexico to do that important work, then the production of the agricultural industry wouldn't have been able to keep up.
That's right. They couldn't have been able, especially in the dried grapes, you know, making into raisins. Now, all our stuff was fresh shipped. We had nothing other than the dried figs. The fresh figs we packed, but the dried figs, well, we dried them and stacked them up, sold them locally.
The other thing that comes to mind, so you mentioned in high school, you're running around with Yo and Sho, and you knew their sister, and there are other Japanese-American families in the area.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you saw what happened to them after Pearl Harbor.
Yes, yes, that was sad. In fact, our neighbors was a Japanese family. The man had got injured, and he tried to commit suicide, and he didn't fake. That got him into the doctor and got him taken care of, and then he had a wreck. He was in the hills, and I think it was deliberate. But she was very good. We had a plum orchard across the street from him. She'd gather that wood up for fire. And when I had to take her to the train, when they shipped them out, she had three children, and take her to the train, and they wouldn't let her keep a butcher knife. So I still got that butcher knife.
What happened to their property, their home, all of that?
Well, they didn't have any property. They were workers. That particular family didn't have any workers, you know. But like you and Sho, their property was really taken good care of. Most of the people kept the property up. I know Yo and Sho. It was just like when they left us, you know, very good.
So someone stepped in and maintained it for them so it would be there when they got back.
Another Japanese guy that said I like real well was Bill Sheba. He was in my class, and as far as I know, his property was well maintained while he was gone, too.
Was it something that emotionally, intellectually, you had to wrestle with at the time, that here these classmates of yours who were born in America just like you were being treated so much differently?
Well, yes, it was. We only had one incident that I know of in Dinuba, and that was a family there. Well, the husband had a radio contact with Japan, and the big planes was flying around, and they finally located it, put him in jail, and he committed suicide. Yeah, but most the families that I knew, they were all just good people.
Did you ever find out what happened to the family you had to take to the train station?
No, I know the girl. I don't know what happened to the boy. They had two girls. One was young. Boy was in the middle. The girl stayed back east someplace and went to work there. I never saw him after that.
All right. So, you know, the war effort is underway. A lot of guys your age are going, and I'm sure you have access to exemptions, right, for being agriculturally necessary?
Yeah, I had exemptions there. So I didn't go in right away.
You're also newly married, too.
Yeah, I was suddenly married, yeah.
So is that something that weighed on you over time?
Yes, it did. It weighed on me. I always felt I should go as like everybody else, you know. But
were you hearing stories about some of your classmates and what they were doing?
Oh, yeah. Most of my classmates went to Germany. A couple of them were pilots, and we got shot down. And I didn't hear much about the ones that went to the Pacific.
Were there any guys from your class who were killed over there?
Yes. Yes, several of them. One real good friend of mine, he was killed in Italy.
But so you're keeping the ranch going, doing this work, and the newspaper's telling you so-and-so is here and this is what happened to him.
Oh, yeah.
So what changed for you? How did you eventually end up in the Army?
Because I could see the draft coming, you know, sooner or later it's coming, you know. And believe it or not, I enlisted in the Navy. And I went up to Camp Beale. That's where they were being inducted at the time. They found a murmur in my heart. They kept me there 3 days, and I was working giving shots to the guys that was going in. And so 3 days later, why, they sent me to San Francisco. And you know the Navy man, what he done to me? He stamped right across that where it said limited duty Navy. He stamped general duty Army. I said, I enlisted the Navy. He said, we're not taking anybody to the Navy today. So I ended up in the Army. Thank God.
That probably wasn't your attitude at the time, though.
No, it wasn't my attitude that, but one trip over, it changed.
Uh-huh. How did your wife feel about all of that? How'd you handle it with her?
It was okay with her because our son was born, and he was just a baby when I shipped out.
So you're shipping out, and you're leaving behind a wife and a newborn son.
Yes.
That couldn't have been easy.
It wasn't very easy, no. But she understood. She's a good Christian, and she understood the necessity that we had to win this war.
Was there a question in your mind as to whether you'd make it back to see them again?
I didn't give it any thought, tell you the truth about it. I just knew I'd make it back.
The fact that we're talking to him is evidence of that, but that does not mean he didn't experience close calls overseas. We'll hear about one of those and some very moving moments he experienced in Japan when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
If you're a business owner, I've got a phone number you really ought to take down, 800-989-1139. And when I say business owner, I mean businesses of all shapes and sizes, from the multinational chain to the hot dog stand on the corner, or my personal preference, the taco truck. 800-989-1139. Because you can have the greatest product or service in the world, the best business plan, the most capable workforce, and still not maximize your potential if you don't have a reliable, efficient, and versatile plan for processing payments. 800-989-1139. That's the number for my friends at Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in the country. Why is Provident growing so fast? Because they're committed to helping your business grow. 800-989-1139. That nonprofit you love that relies on donations? Provident can even connect you to a special software platform to streamline and stimulate giving. If you are ready to grow, give it a go. Go Provident today at providentpayments.com or call that number, 800-989-1139.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 99-year-old Bill Biggers of Fresno, California, meeting up at his favorite spot, the Veterans Memorial Museum, home of the Legion of Valor in downtown Fresno, where he volunteers as a docent every Tuesday. The museum is open 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. Monday through Saturday, and admission is always free. Bill spent most of World War II helping to grow produce that would feed our soldiers around the world, but in early 1945, he left his wife and newborn son behind in California and headed overseas with the Army. Had you ever been on a ship before, Bill?
No, that was my first and the last time I wanted to be, but I had several others besides that. Yeah, one of them was the USS Barnstable, and that's what it felt like, too. It was not a good ship.
Did it smell like a barn stable?
Well, it didn't smell very good.
Well, tell me about it. So what do you remember about shipping out and heading overseas?
Well, it took us 30 days to get over there because of zigzag.
From San Francisco to Manila?
Yeah. Well, we stopped. There were three ships of us, and we'd had an escort all the way. And we backed up into an island of someplace out there in the Pacific for camouflage. And the next morning, we head out, the three ships, no escort. One right behind the other. Navy guy said we're top speed, and we went right through the war zone and to Manila. I can't understand how we made it, but we did.
And when you say that, you know, before you had escort, now you don't. There's the threat of Japanese submarines all along that way.
Oh, yes. Plus, they still had a few bombers, too, you know.
Sure. The threat aircraft, from the air as well. Uh-huh. And did you get seasick at all?
No. Just the sailors got seasick.
Army's immune to it?
Well, I'll leave out part of that.
Feel free.
Going over, we didn't do, there's four of us didn't want to do calisthenics, you know. We hid out in lifeboats just hanging over the side, and the Navy guys brought our food to us.
How long did you get away with that?
All the way.
30 days?
Well, we only stayed that during the daytime. We went down and sat.
So you never once had to do calisthenics.
But we got to be good card players, I'm telling you.
So you hid in the lifeboats
yeah.
every day, and nobody ever found you?
Nobody ever tried.
I wonder if anybody who's listening is going to try to get away with that at some point. It's like straight out of the movies or something.
Oh, yeah. But anyway, we landed in Manila in Luzon. There were still firefights. There's still some fighting going on, especially in Wall City. We ran out by rail, and we went 19 kilometers from Manila to a little village called Alabang. It consisted of just a few stands along selling sarsaparilla and Cokes, and then we went further in from Alabang. One morning, First Sergeant come in to our tent, and he says, "Biggers, get dressed. We got a mission to go to." This is at 3:30, and he said, "The truck will be leaving at 4. The only thing I asked him, "Shall I bring the M1 or the carbine?" Although I was assigned to a bigger gun, a Browning automatic, but that's not good in jungle fighting. It's too big, too heavy. So he said, "Bring the M1. So that's what I brought, was the M1. We get on that truck, and 8 hours later, we stopped. We was in pretty heavy jungle type thing area, and the road was good. But I was in the back with another soldier I did not know, American soldier. And I think we had 8 Filipino guerrilla fighters and the first sergeant and the truck driver. And we stopped to rest and have a bite to eat, and all hell broke loose. Because what we were after was the main body of the Japanese had surrendered, but we had these ones that skipped out, got away, and they were causing a lot of trouble, and we were up there to find them.
So these are some Japanese who didn't want to surrender, who then went further back, and you had to kind of round them up, or that was the hope anyway.
That was the hope, yeah, but yeah. They found us before we found them.
So you're thinking you're taking a lunch break, and when did you know that's not what was happening?
Very shortly. We didn't get to eat anything.
Because they started firing on you.
Firing started coming, but it was very fortunate because we were somewhat protected unless they came over the hill. It was just a small risings, but our truck never got hit. This American soldier that was with me, we crawled about, I'd say close to 100 feet down through the jungle. There was a trail there, but we didn't want to get on the trail because we could be seen. So we crawled down to the waterfront. We had noticed this every once in a while you could see this water. It was not running, it was just standing water. And the Japanese were on the other side of that.
So you crawled down there on your bellies?
On our bellies.
The enemy is still firing in your direction?
Oh, yeah. Now we could be seen. Now he and I could. I don't know what happened to the other people at that time because they never came down.
So they might have stayed with the truck.
Evidently, I don't think the Filipinos did because when we got back the truck after a couple hours, there were no Filipinos around.
But for a couple hours, you're in a situation you've never been in before.
Absolutely. It's not like when you're in basic training, when you crawl underneath that wiring, you know, and they're firing above you, telling you that it's live ammunition, but it's probably blanks. But that was live, and we knew it.
How close was it coming to you?
Not really that close, because it was heavy jungle where we had crawled down, and we separated probably 20 feet apart, because if they spotted one, they might not sight the other one, you know. And we were pretty well hid, and we had plenty of ammo.
But there's only two of you.
Only two of us.
And you don't know how many of the Japanese there are.
Have no idea, because across this water, it'd be hard for me to estimate how across it was that water. And it wasn't running, it was just standing water,
mm-hmm.
muddy. They were in we thought it was an island out in this water. That's what it looked like to us. And that was grown up with banana trees, and they were inside that. You couldn't see anybody.
So what were those 2 hours like? What kind of things were you doing, and what were you dealing with?
Well, it was just a gunfight. That's all you can say about it. And they never did get close to us because we were pretty well hid. I don't know. So finally we figured either they escaped, or we, no telling what happened. We didn't know what happened, because we wouldn't dare get out into that water, because first place we didn't know how deep it was, and if it was not very deep, we'd be standing objects, you know.
With no cover.
No cover, and we didn't want to duck down in that muddy water, because we didn't know what else was in that muddy water either.
So after a couple hours, you don't know if you've hit any of them. You don't know if they've gotten away.
Oh, yeah, we were pretty sure we hit them.
Well, this is why I'm asking the questions.
Yeah, we were pretty sure we hit them. We saw some kind of an automatic weapon coming out. We could see we could see that firing. We couldn't see the ones it was using with rifles or whatever, but we saw that automatic weapon. I don't even know what it was. It's just like a machine gun, but it was automatic, you know. And we both fired at that, and it dumped out into the water. So we knew that one was gone. But finally, the gunfire stopped. Then we found out that was not an island. It was just a outcropping, I guess you'd call it, into this water.
Mm-hmm.
And so we don't know how many got away.
Thinking it's an island and they'd have to go through the water, but afterwards you found out they could have backed out where you couldn't see.
Yeah, we couldn't see where they went back to land. It was a peninsula, in other words.
Mm-hmm. So the gunfire stops. I imagine that's kind of a nervous deal to figure out when it's safe to move.
Yeah, we wait. We give it plenty of time. We'd fire a couple of rounds in just to make sure. We didn't get in return fire, so we assumed it. So we started back. On the way back, we come across two recently killed Japanese soldiers. How they were killed, I don't know. But it was very recent. And it didn't seem like they might have came from, I don't know how they got across that water, because we didn't see any way to get across on land the water. They were dry. Their clothes were dry.
Hmm.
Anyway, we left them. You know, we went on to our thing. And when we got back to our truck, there were no Filipinos. And the first sergeant was a basket case. The truck driver had tried to keep him safe. They got in behind the wheels of the truck, just in case. And that's where we found the truck driver and the first sergeant. But the first sergeant was a basket case, really. He had gone berserk, but we later found out that was his first trip overseas. He had always been in a unit in the States.
So the two of them had stayed with the truck the whole time?
They stayed in the truck the whole time, yeah. And we tried to find the Filipinos, but we never found them. I don't know where they went. But anyway, we found a place we could turn that truck around and hit it back to base. But that lasted about 22 hours altogether, the time we got back to the base.
Sounds like that might have been one of the longest days of your young life.
Well, you know, I was raised in church. I was not a guy that went out drinking and all that jazz all my life. I had been raised in church, and you won't believe this, but the first thing I thought of when the gunfire started was the 23rd Psalms.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, we'll walk through the valley of death. Have no fear. And I had no fear.
Wow. There's something that you felt in that
moment. I felt I was safe.
Mm.
I really did.
You get back from that firefight. You said, you know, your first sergeant was a basket case, I think is the word you used.
Yes, he was shipped home.
And I guess maybe partly because of what happened to him, you had some issues you had to straighten out where they thought were absent without leave?
Well, this first sergeant, I could never get to know him, you know, just that one trip is all I had with him.
Mm-hmm.
But he had failed to list us. I don't know about the Filipinos, where he listed them or not, but this other soldier and I were AWOL. It took a little while to get that straightened out because he's a basket case.
So he's not in the kind of mental state to clear anything up.
No.
You're not recorded anywhere on paper as having left for that mission.
No, the only thing that saved us was the truck driver.
So he vouched for you.
Yeah, he vouched for us, yeah.
Otherwise, you would have been in big trouble.
We would have been in big trouble. The only thing that really upset me about it, because the first sergeant had not listed us anything about it, we never got the medal for being in a firefight.
The combat infantry badge?
Combat infantry badge. We never got that. That really stuck with me because we should have got it.
Maybe you still could. But what about the surrender and how you heard about that and what that meant to you?
Well, we had shipped back to our company. This happened on Lausanne. We shipped down to Leyte. No action down on Leyte. I think we were there 2 or 3 weeks. And then we went down to Mindanao, where the 121st was stationed. They were back on R&R. We had some incidents of the enemy slipping up and shooting into the unit, but nobody ever got hit. Because you soon learn, don't stand up. You might have a hole in the tent, but that's better than have a hole in your head. So, yeah, with that. And we had, at that time, we had quite a few Japanese prisoners there, too. But they gave us no trouble. No trouble. They was glad to be fed. And
when word came that Japan had surrendered, was that something that meant something to you?
Yeah, I imagine we got it fairly quick. You know, I don't really remember. Well, we were expecting it, you know, because they'd already dropped the atomic bomb, and we were expecting it any time. The only thing you had to worry about was the food we were getting was not good. For a month, we had nothing but Spam. That poor cook had tried fixing Spam every possible way you could fix Spam. Anyway, after the war ended and we went to Japan, it's hard to believe this, but of course I was in the headquarters now. After about 2 weeks, we took over a Japanese base, which is right near the town of Okayama. So about 2 weeks, the four of us, it was the card-playing nuts from...
The lifeboat crew?
From the lifeboat crew. We decided we'd walk into town. The town had been hit very, very hard, very hard. It had been pretty well damaged. We heard from the Japanese that there's planes of bombers over that for about 7 hours straight. Not just American, but other bombers, too. And it had been hit pretty hard, but as we walk into this little town, the main part of town, some of the business part, hadn't been hit that hard. But the town had burnt because they knocked out the water. And it's an oceanfront town. Had been hit that part, but there's only one building standing in a big, Vance area there. One building, a two-story building. And you won't believe this. Gospel music. Although they were singing in Japanese, we knew the songs. So we joined them.
Wow.
Yeah, we went in and we were taking off our boots and we saw a little girl peek out from upstairs because they were upstairs. And then she went back in. And then we found out later that she went back in and the pastor of the church asked her, what's going on? She says, American soldiers. What are they doing? They're taking their boots off. He says, that sounds good because we know they're friendly now because they're following our customs.
Mm-hmm.
So we joined them and we sang with them.
Some hymns that you had sung in church
growing
up.
Oh, yeah, that we knew that. And the funny part about this, four of us, I was raised in the Assembly of God. One guy was a Baptist. One guy was a Church of Christ. And the fourth guy was a Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
So what a team.
Got all your bases covered.
Got all our bases covered. So we joined them. After the service, the pastor, just after that, they followed our customs like we do. They all joined hands so the circle won't be unbroken and had prayer. And so we took this little Japanese girl, looked like she's probably 18, 19 years old, and I took her hand and my soldiers, and we all joined hands. And then after the pastor came back, and of course we had the books, you know, from Japanese to American to Japanese. And he came back and tried to talk to us a little bit. And the little girl that I sat next to, she invited us to their home.
Mm.
So we went to their home. They wanted to give us something to eat. They had nothing to speak of.
Mm.
They had put on the ranch we called horse beans. I don't remember the real name of them, but it's a big bean like a lima, only a little larger.
Mm-hmm.
And they baked those. They open up and you eat the kernel inside. That gave us an idea. We could buy food at the PX. Very reasonable. I can remember the one thing I can vaguely remember was Sacramento tomato juice. A big old can, probably a quart or maybe bigger, 15 cents.
Mm-hmm.
So we took a lot of food to them. A lot of food, because they were starving. At our camp, we'd go out after we ate, you know, and the Japanese men, 50, 60 years old, digging the garbage for food. Well, the four of us didn't do that. If it's something we didn't particularly want or didn't, like a slice of bread, we didn't throw it in the garbage. So they brought, they realized the four of us was going to throw it in the garbage, so they'd bring buckets so they could put the good food in. So we took a lot of food to those to that family. And I told this girl very plainly now, we brought you this food, and don't you sell it. If we bring you more than you want, you want to give it to your friends, that's all right. But don't you sell it. We gave it to you because you were hungry. And as far as I know, they never sold that. So we stayed there, visited with that Japanese family and other Japanese family, not just them. All the time that we were, the 11 months I was in that service. And of course, two of them were single and two of us were married. And we were truthful with them because we told them we were married and there was, you know, nothing going on between us and the family. And I can remember when I got my shipping orders. Well, they think I overstepped that. We were moving from Okayama down to Nagasaki. They thought we were going home. And these two girls, the older one and the younger one, come, and they found us as we were getting on the train. And they said to me, Bill-san, Maureen and Ronnie say, Bill, come home. We say, Bill, stay. So anyway, no, we went down then to Nagasaki, and I left and come home from Nagasaki. I saw the devastation there. I didn't see much in Nagasaki, but they stopped the train there. We wasn't allowed to get off, but you sure see the devastation. We stopped at the railroad station. Just nothing but a few walls left standing.
That experience where you and your friend, well, three of your friends, you stumble into this church and they're singing the hymns and their words are Japanese, but you know the tune and you're singing along. Is there something that moment, that experience taught you, or when you think back on it now, it makes you realize?
Well, the thing that I realized about it, it wasn't the Japanese people. It was the government that was rotten. We never had 1 minute's problem with the Japanese people. Not one problem at all. Now, this family, their father had been killed in Manchuria when that war was going on. It seemed to me that the civilians were nice people.
It's time for our final break, but there's much more to come with 99-year-old Bill Biggers, including that chance to finally come home and see his wife and son again. He would spend most of his professional life with the Fresno Police Department. In fact, he is the oldest living retired officer from that department. Check out photos and a video of one of Bill's wildest police stories online at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. And close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328. When life throws you curveballs, you have to be adaptable, or at least have a good pinch hitter on the bench who knows how to handle a curve. When it comes to your business, Provident Payments is the best teammate you could ever have. Perhaps it helps that many of the leaders for one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America are former ballplayers. Contactless payments, online ordering, point of sale, you name it, Provident Payments knows it. Now, you could get some of these services from one of the big banking companies, but you're never going to get the kind of personalized service that Provident Payments delivers every day. 24/7 solution-based tech support. When your ability to process payments goes haywire in any way, time is money. So would you rather wait on hold for who knows how long, or would you like to have a direct line you can call for immediate help? That's where a good teammate comes in. Learn more about bringing Provident Payments onto your team at providentpayments.com. They really are one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. That website again, providentpayments.com.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with 99-year-old Bill Biggers at the Veterans Memorial Museum in downtown Fresno, California. You'll find him there every Tuesday. The museum's open from 10 to 3 Monday through Saturday. Bill saw combat in the Philippines in the final months of World War II, then spent the next 11 months in occupation duty in Japan. By the fall of 1946, he finally had the chance to come home and see his wife and their young son again.
I thought I'd fly out. But I didn't. We came back by ship. It wasn't a barn stable, though. It might have been worse. I don't know. But we was out 2 days, and one engine quit. I don't know. Gosh, we're going back to Yokohama. No, they got it going, and three or 4 days later, maybe a week. I don't remember how long. Both engines quit. Now we're out there bobbling in the ocean, you know. They couldn't cook. So we had apples and crackers and that kind of stuff to eat for about a day and a half. And they got both engines going, and we ended up back in the Bay Area. Now, I see I didn't have time to contact my wife. I was coming home.
She didn't know?
She didn't know. We landed there in Oakland, and we got a pass to go into San Francisco, and I called her. She said, "Where are you?" I said, "San Francisco. What do you expect?" So she picked me up down back at Camp Beale. I told her, I said, "I'll make reservations for you in the hotel or motel, whatever I can get in Marysville." And so I made reservations for her, and two of my sisters came with her. And she was there the next day. And I said, "Now, they told us we was going to get on the train at 10 o'clock in the morning, and we'd be in Marysville by 4 o'clock that afternoon." And they gave us a lunch. You won't believe this. We got there at 4 o'clock in the morning. I could have walked it faster. We were on the siding all the time. See, they didn't need us now. There's no war going on, so they right. didn't need us. So we sat on the siding. When I went in the service, it was, you're right there. But no, they didn't need us, so we was on the siding. Can you imagine 10 o'clock in the morning till 4 o'clock the next morning, just going from Oakland to Marysville? You could have walked it.
Your wife's been waiting for you to get home all this time.
Oh, she came, you know, and of course they give you this deal, because they're going to give you quite a bit of cash then, you know, it was quite mm-hmm. a bit of cash. And so they'd warn you, you know, there'd be women around wanting to relieve you of your cash, you know. They didn't want to go in Marysville, you know. I mean, in the base. So they would stop and ask, so the soldiers would walk off, wouldn't talk to them. So they went to the base, and the commander there told them, says, "No, they'll be here at about 4 o'clock in the morning. Do you have a place?" And they says, "Yeah, we've already got it. So you might as well go on back there, because they won't be here till 4 o'clock in the morning." And so they went back to the hotel. I got them a hotel. And the next morning they picked us up, and it didn't take us long to go through there and give you orders. And she had borrowed my dad's Oldsmobile. And then there's a Mexican boy that I graduated with, had came home with us. He wasn't in our unit, but I came home with him, and he didn't have a ride home. So we'll just take you home.
So the people at Camp Beale thought your wife and your sister were trying to find some some guys to take some money off of.
No, not the guys there, just the guys that was getting discharged.
They had the wrong idea about what they were there for.
They had a wrong idea, yeah. So that was quite odd, yeah. But then afterwards, I actually didn't get out of service. I had quite a bit of time, so I actually came home the 1st of September, and I wasn't discharged until December. But I wanted to get to work. So my dad wanted to retire, and I grew up on that ranch. And even though it's a big ranch, I still do every inch of it, you know. And so those San Francisco boys wanted me to come back and take over my dad's job because I knew the ranch. So we moved back to the ranch, and they built a new home for us. I stayed there 6 years, and I couldn't stand it anymore. You couldn't hire anybody. Nobody wanted to work anymore. I stayed there 6 years and signed up to go on the Fresno Police Department.
And there's a lot more to that, but before I forget, I mean, what was it like to see your wife again? You'd been gone for so long.
Yeah, it was great. You just can't imagine. And the fact she didn't even know I was coming home, it surprised her more than...
And what about seeing your son?
Well, because I missed out on him growing up because he was just a baby when I left.
Mm-hmm.
Now he's up walking and talking and he told me later, now I lost my son last year. He told me it was the greatest thing any kid, there's no kid was as lucky as I was. He says, I got to learn to drive tractor because he was a little guy and he'd drive that Ford tractor and sometimes he'd drive a truck even though he could barely reach the pedals. He just to unload the boxes. You know, scatter them in the field for picking because we all ship grain. And he got to do a little of everything. And so he got to go with me. He says, you know, very few kids got to do that with their dad. So, yeah, he said, I was the luckiest guy in the world.
When you got home, did he know who you were?
Yeah, I think so. Because I sent a lot of pictures home, you know. I think he did because he seemed to, you know.
How many years did you put in with the Fresno Police Department?
Well, I spent 22 years. I was 52 when I called it quits. I had a very, very interesting deal with the police department. I came on and I started my career with them working the major accident car. That car only took the injury accidents or death. But I started that and then I went to patrol. And then the chief felt that the new officers need to know what goes on in headquarters. So since my initial started with a B, I was the first one in the office. So I got to spend 4 months in the office as a dispatcher and run the phones and run the, as we call it, the sergeant's desk that take care of people coming in. Now midnight eight, you didn't get too many. But anyway, that was a very good experience, and I appreciate the chief. It turned out I was the only one that ever had to go in there. So I volunteered for motors. Now, I grew up with motors. I had a couple of uncles that were motorcycle riders, and one of them had a motorcycle dealership. And so I grew up riding motors, too, you know. So I went on motors with the intent of staying only 2 years and going to something else. I stayed eight because we formed a drill team. And we put on shows on the weekends when you're supposed to be home, you know, playing ball with a boy or somebody, you know. We were putting on shows all over the valley. Once a year, we spent a week in Los Angeles in that area putting on shows down there. I can remember one of them that we put on. We were in the stadium, and they turned all the lights out on us in darkness. We didn't crash, and, you know, motorcycles don't do very good on lawn. But there was no accidents. Everything went real smooth. We were best in the state 3 years in a row. We were invited to the Madison Square Garden, all expense paid, even with our wives, and they'd fly our motors back there, and the city manager declined to let us go. But I went from motors to detective. A lot of experience in detective. I got to work a lot of different things. And from there, I went to forgery. That was a great experience because they don't teach anything about handwriting. And so I went up to DOJ and handwriting expert there, stayed a couple of days and learned a little bit about handwriting. So I stayed in that 3 years in forgery, and then I went to homicide. And I worked 7 years as a homicide officer.
I'm sure all of that experience, and I know you've remained connected to the police department ever since, I'm sure that experience gave you some perspective on what it takes to be a good law enforcement officer.
Well, I always felt you should put in a full day's work and do the best you can. It's a difficult job at any time, you know, because you want to do the right thing. You've got to treat people right. I don't care what they've done. You've got to treat them right. because they're human beings. Show them respect, you know. But I don't want the police abused either. The way it looks now, it's only going to get worse. I hope not.
Yeah,
I can hope for the best, but I don't know where it's going. I think we've lost track of what our country's all about.
And maybe that's part of why you volunteer here at the museum.
Probably so, yeah. You know, and I get very, very disgusted with our television. We don't get much advertisement. Maybe we should get some free advertisement. Of course, you know, I've been here like on Veterans Day and other big celebrations.
Mm-hmm.
And people come in here, I didn't know about this. Like we've only been here about 20 years.
Well, what do you think people should know about the museum? Why should they come and check it out?
Well, it's history to start with. They should know what we represent here. Now, sometimes we had one lady come in and really got upset about our display of from Japan. And she started screaming, get that stuff out of here. Get that stuff out of here. And we tried to explain to her, this is history.
Mm-hmm.
We're not back in the Japanese War and, you know, saying it was good. We're trying to give you history about what goes and what we should be doing instead of the nonsense that's been going on lately. Of course, I've got a guy that likes to go to all museums, too. I don't care what they are. I still like to go to museums and see, learn about the past, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Although I got a lot of past my own. I mean, you could read about history, but sometimes it's not really as accurate as coming down here and seeing these displays. You know, clear back to the Civil War. I tell people you could spend all day in here.
You can. And besides the artifacts, the representations, the photographs, the narratives, they got people like you. And you live some of this history yourself. You've got almost 100 years worth of history that you've seen with your own eyes. And I know you share some of that with the people who come here. So in light of those who didn't come home from World War II, your 406,000 fellow Americans who died while serving in World War II, how do we need to remember them all these years later?
The honor they displayed by going over there and fighting for us to keep us like we are today, not like we are today, like we were. They felt honored, most of them, because you sure had a few that, you know, went AWOL. But 99% of them went over there willing to give their lives for others so they could enjoy what we did enjoy here in the United States, because this is the greatest in the world, you know. There's nothing, no place like the United States.
I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for the way you continue to serve your country, your community, your fellow man. Is there something that you would say at 99 going on 100 that you're most proud of or you're most thankful for?
Well, I think the most thing you could be proud of is being born in the United States. With all the freedom we did have, and to see what's going on today is very disgusting to me. But I think we'll get it straightened out. I hope so. But there's just a lot of wonderful people that work here,
mm-hmm,
and started this museum. And
yep,
the fact that they give their time. And we enjoy it, too. As I have people say, what do you guys do down there? Oh, we sit around, drink coffee, and tell lies.
But he promises everything he said in this hour was the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. That is Bill Biggers, 99 years old. He'll hit the century mark this November. And there's one more story of his that may sound too crazy to be true. You'll find a video of him telling that story at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. It's about the time in 1960 when he was knocked off of his police motorcycle by a deer. It really happened. He was fortunate to survive. You can check out that video online. And better yet, go hear the story from Bill in person at the Veterans Memorial Museum in Fresno, California, where he spends every single Tuesday. Thanks so much for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.